This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking Memorial Day weekend 2018 by reflecting on some of the amazing veterans who have left us in the past year. Their stories live on and always will, and Chet Thomason had quite a story. He passed away in September, 2 days shy of his 95th birthday, but that was just months after a group of football players from Fresno City College in California had carried him down, literally picked him up and carried him down to the famed Crystal Cave in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. 77 years earlier, Chet had helped lay explosives that made that cave accessible for tourists. And we would never know that story if Chet hadn't survived the sinking of his ship, the destroyer USS Monson, on November 13th, 1942.
Friday 13th, I figured out my lucky day.
Well, I guess you can look at different parts of that day and say it was both lucky and unlucky.
Yep, I lived through it, so my lucky day.
Well, you guys got torpedoed.
Right.
In the middle of the night.
Right.
Where were you when that happened?
I was in my bunk.
Well, that'll wake you up.
You're right. Prepare to abandon ship. I saw a 10-foot 4x4 out there, and I told the other guys that were with me. There was three guys. I was just making for that log, for that 4x4. That's what we did.
So you jumped in and you swam for the 4x4?
Right.
And you made it?
Right.
How long did you end up being in the water?
14 hours.
14 hours in the water?
Yeah. I had one shark come up to take a bite of me, and I saw his teeth. I took both feet and kicked him out in the side of the face and left me alone.
And you were all alone at that point?
Right.
So you guys are floating on this 4x4, and you see sharks in the water.
Yep.
What does that do to you? I think most people would be scared out of their minds.
Well, I had Navy shoes on, so I drew back and my both feet, and I kicked him in the side of the face.
Mm-hmm. What's going through your mind for 14 hours in the water?
I don't know. Don't remember.
Did you think you were going to die?
Nope.
Why not?
I was too young and invincible. My body was invincible.
Your ship wasn't.
Well, I was.
Did you see your ship go under?
Yep, it was on fire. Burning.
You're one of the last guys left from that ship. How do you think the guys who died that night should be remembered? What should people know about who they were and the kind of guys they were?
There was somebody's son, and somebody would say, well, I had a son that died in the war.
Another haunting reminder of what Memorial Day is all about. That was Chet Thomason, who passed away in September, 2 days shy of his 95th birthday. John Cardinale was 96 when we met him last year. He had kept his World War II story secret for decades because he was part of the OSS, predecessor to the CIA, operating behind enemy lines in Europe during the war and having to consider the ugly prospect of what he would do if captured.
I was given a medical bag and two cyanide tablets in case I would capture in a bad position. All that, take a cyanide tablet, you're out. You're dead.
And you were prepared to kill yourself if it came to that?
Yeah, right. Depends on the condition at the time, you know. But after the war was over, I got them. I took them away. It was scary. I was really scared many, many times. They're all scared, no matter who you are. They're all scared. You live from day to day. There's always something new every day, and I felt sorry for all these kids that got killed. Thank God I pulled through it, and I came out of my right senses. I still thank God for what I've done and being alive at 96 years old. So you never know how much longer I've got. I know I'm one of the few left.
How hard was it for all those years? I mean, your book is called 65 Years of Secrecy. That's a long time. How often over the course of those 65 years did you wish you could have told someone? Did you want to be able to talk about what you did?
I was dying to tell some, especially close friends, my buddies of mine, golf, playing golf and all that here in Monterey, fishermen, where I was a contractor, a painting contractor, an employer, and never told my men anything. I just as an employer, you know. I was just dying to tell them, but I held up, thank God, and nobody knew until 2008. Then it went public by the National Archives, and that's it.
Yeah, so the National Archives releases this, all the names of people who worked with the OSS. Some of those are famous names, movie stars, famous chefs, politicians, Supreme Court justices, and Johnny Cardinale. He's right there on the list. So was that a relief for you when that happened?
It was a relief. Boy, sure, it's just like letting out gas. That was quite a relief. Anyway, it was quite a relief. And I was proud of myself for what I did. And a lot of people wouldn't believe it. Like I say, there's only a few left. You probably count them with your fingers on your hand. That's how many's left.
John Cardinale passed away November 5th at the age of 96, and 2 weeks later, we lost Jim McCrory, too. Jim was with the 2nd Marine Division for the Battle of Guadalcanal.
We were going to assault Tanambogo, and they wanted all automatic weapons on top of this hill to fire over on Tanambogo, which was about 400 yards away and connected with what they called the causeway, which was a road that had been coral dredged up and piled up and made a road between the two.
So again, these two islands are both right in the harbor.
Right,
they're connected
inside
by
the
this
harbor.
Little causeway.
Connected by this little
so
causeway.
So you're firing from a high point
over on
Gavutu over to Tanambogo.
Right, and it was all so right. far that my tracers were actually burning out before they got there. I couldn't aim or anything, but I could do like a garden hose. I could watch my tracers and tell where my bullets were going. So anyhow, I was up there for a few minutes firing, and there was people like me, and there had been a Jap observation point up there where they had dug a pit about 8 by 8 and built a roof over it. And unknown to us, there was a Japanese flag on top of that roof. And there was a squadron of SBDs from the Enterprise bombing Tanambogo, just circling around and wanted to peel off and bomb and come up. And this guy, I looked up, and I saw him point right at me. And I saw that 500-pound bomb detached from his airplane. So instead of getting up and running, he was probably 1,200 foot high or something. I just got on my hands and knees, and I went backwards as fast as I could go down that hill. And before the bomb went off, I must have got maybe this much of the curve of the hill between me and the bomb. And it went off, and everything turned black. And I thought, I remember so clearly my thinking. I thought, well, I'm dead. Then it turned gray. I thought, well, I'm not dead. And I looked up, and I could see 2x4 and pieces of tin and stuff circling in the air. And I thought, well, those will kill me when they come down. But they didn't, except that I was stone deaf. However, that bomb lit right on top of the roof of that building. We had 2 complete sets of air-cooled 30 caliber Browning machine guns with their crews in there. And those people, we didn't find bodies. They were gone, just totally vanished. And then there were several other men wounded, but I was not. As I say, I just had this shock, this deafness and concussion. And 500-pound bomb is this big around and that high, you know. They're not a little bitty thing.
Very destructive.
They'll sink a ship.
And so everybody listening understands here. So you had taken this position.
Yes.
Not knowing that above you is flying a Japanese flag.
No, I did not know that. Nor did anyone else, or we'd have got it down.
You couldn't see it from where you were
No,
coming.
It was on. There was a corrugated metal roof over this observation point, and this flag was flat on this corrugated iron roof.
How did you guys find out about the flag?
Because somebody found it later. It didn't totally destroy.
Ah, they found it in the rubble.
Found it in the rubble.
So
still on some of the metal.
So no one can fault this SBD dive bomber pilot for seeing a Japanese flag and
we did not fault him, even though, you know, it's called friendly fire.
Yep.
We did not fault the man. But the instant that happened, they all vanished in a flash because I'm sure the others were saying, hey, the ones who knew, but we did not fault him.
The story you're telling really underscores how a real minute detail can have a huge life or death impact on
Correct.
People. Correct. No one had any idea that flag's up there.
Had no idea.
And you say those bodies were disintegrated.
They were gone.
How many people do you think were killed?
In that little group were 8, and there were probably 3 more killed up and down the top of that little hill. Then there were a lot who were like me, you know, were shocked or deafened or whatever. In fact, this friend of mine who maybe the rest of the time there was never more than 3 or 4 foot from me. When these people were killed, this is horrible. I'll tell you some horrible things, make you sick. Blood flew. There's a lot of blood in 8 or 10 people. And this friend of mine was drenched in this blood. He was as shocked as I was. And he got a few splinters of shrapnel in his arms, but he wasn't really injured. And when the corpsman came up there, they saw him all bloody, and they asked him, you know, what's wrong with you? And he said, I'm okay, you know. But they thought he was out of his mind from the bomb, so they forced him onto a stretcher and took him down to the aid station, where they cleaned him up, and they found out there was nothing wrong with him. Then they chewed him for having used 4 stretcher bearers and taking up the doctor's time and stuff.
Even though he told him he was
fine. Though he kept trying to tell him he was okay. But would you believe a man drenched in blood where a bomb had detonated maybe 30 foot from his head was okay?
Well, and how far were you from where it detonated?
Probably 25, 30 foot.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but my interpretation of what you've shared with me is that by any reasonable expectation, you should not have survived that.
I should not, no. No, it was by the grace of God, by scooting backwards on my hands and knees, I probably got that much of the curve of the mountain between me and the bomb.
Yeah, and like if you a foot get, or so. Uh-huh.
Yeah, if you get that much, it will throw the impact up. Or if I hadn't have had that, I would have disintegrated like the rest of them.
You had about a foot of overhang that redirected the shrapnel.
I would estimate that, yes.
Uh-huh.
Because this all took place in seconds. When I looked up and I could see the bomb turn loose,
yeah.
You know, it's like somebody throws a rock at you. You know where it's going to hit? Well, I knew it was going to hit me.
Mm-hmm.
I could see it. So all, and there was nothing I could do. I couldn't get up and run. I didn't have time. So that's where I said I scooted backwards. I only had seconds to do it, so I couldn't have got more than 25 or 30 foot down the mountain. So I'm only guessing.
So your life is spared.
Yes.
But you told us you couldn't hear anything.
Not for 2 or 3 days.
2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. How did you communicate for those 2 or 3 days?
We just didn't.
Did you get any nicks or scratches or anything else from it?
I did not.
Nothing. Wow.
And the whole time on Guadalcanal and everywhere else, outside of this eye being damaged by the front sight of a Springfield rifle, I never got a scratch. However, there was fungus and stuff so bad that we all had terrible rotten spots that went clear to the bone on us. Mm-hmm. Ulcers. They were so, if you'd get a scratch on your leg, it would turn into an ulcer. I've still got dimples on my legs from.
I don't want to dwell on, you know, this horrible stuff, but I just want to understand what it was like to be you. Again, you're 20 years old.
Yeah.
You just almost died. You can't hear a thing. You don't know if you're ever going to hear anything again. And a bunch of the guys that you had been there with just got vaporized by one of your own bombs.
Yes.
How do you handle that? How do you deal with that?
Some people can and some people can't. I happen to be one who could. However, not as well as I thought. If I had something to occupy me all the time, I could deal with it all my life. But my first wife was a schizophrenic, and taking care of her occupied me completely. But when I lost her, I began to get terrible attacks of PTSD because I was not totally occupied.
So when your mind has time to wander, that's where it goes.
When my mind has time to wander, it goes to all those dead faces looking at me and that sort of thing.
Wow. And you're speaking in the present tense. This is not something that you're over your past. You know that you're still susceptible to these flashbacks and these bouts of PTSD.
Yes, I am. And this is a very worrisome thing for me about the young men of today, because I know that these young men who were in Iraq and there are not over that at all, just because they're out of there.
You know how many times you came close to not coming home?
Oh, and dozens.
And you know, 7,000, more than 7,000 Americans died in the Battle of Guadalcanal. 406,000 in the war. All these years later, how do we need to remember those who died?
Just as young men who did what they felt was correct for their country to the best of their ability, and try to remember that they were young, virile men who had everything to give to the country, and they weren't here anymore to give it. The country was at a big loss for not having them.
Again, those veterans we're remembering today left us with what is so important to zero in on this Memorial Day weekend. That was Jim McCrory, who passed away in November at the age of 96. 2 weeks later, Jonas Hofer finished his race. 73 years earlier, Jonas had survived the torpedoing of the cruiser USS Houston.
When I came to in the water, there were about 25 of us in the water and that. And you'll think this is funny, and I think it is too, is that we started singing some hymns. And the hymns I remember we sang, one of them was, "There Shall Be Showers of Blessing." Now, why would you sing a song like that? It just seems crazy to me. Why would you sing "There's"? But I guess because most of the sailors knew that song. We sang that and some other hymns and that there in the water. And then it got dark and we got parted. And pretty soon we weren't close. And Dyke and myself, we tied ourselves together with our belts. And we were in the water. And then the next day, the sun came out. During the night, we saw some ships come close. And we were afraid at first they'd go over us, but they didn't. But we were afraid to yell out because we didn't know if they're Japanese or ours, because there were so many ships in the air, Japanese and that. And we were pretty close to Formosa there, too, you know, 80 miles about that time. They figure that during those 2 days, we were towed about 80 miles on the water.
Couple questions. You said when you came to in the water, so did you, and you said you don't remember when you went off the ship. Did you get off the ship under your own power, or were you blown off the ship, or you don't know?
I don't know. I think I got off my own, but I can't remember going over the side of the ship. And then it was after I was in the water, Dyke swam up to me, and I recognized him. So we tied ourselves together with our belts, and then we wanted to stay together.
And did you have a Mae West or any kind of flotation device?
I had two of them. I had a Mae West, and then I had the other one, which is a rubber one that has a little hand. You pull it, and it blows up, and it goes underneath you. The Mae West, after 3 hours, was worthless. It was taking us down that night. And so we both took our Mae West and just dropped, and they sunk, actually. But these rubber ones we had, those were good. Those stayed. And they, if they went down, had a leak in them, they also had something you could blow them. And that's what kept us up till the next day. Yeah.
How many hours were you in the water?
Between 14 and 16. I don't know exactly when we went in. I know I was picked up at about 10 o'clock next morning. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening, while the sun was going down, when we got that second torpedo. And I just don't know, like I say, I cannot reckon at all of when I went in the water. But I know there, because Dyke swam up, and we swam together and tied ourselves together. And we sang these songs in the water. I know that much. And then during the night, we got parted, you know. In the morning, when we got picked up, there was nobody close to us. And the USS Grayson was still in a battle then. The ships were still fighting there again. They'd gotten into battle again. And what they did with our ship, they towed it as bait for the Japanese planes to come out, and then our battleships and those and our pilots would shoot them down. But they missed this one Betty that came in, saw our oil slick, and came in the side and gave us the next torpedo.
I've talked to a few guys who have had to abandon ship and who have had to survive the water for some time. And in different spots, there were different hazards of the water. What did you see? What did you experience floating in the water? I mean, were there things burning around you? Were there things to hold on to? Did you have to fear sharks at all? What did you have to deal with?
There was a lot of wood and stuff and seats and different things in the water. There was a lot of that stuff in the water, a floating metal and some metal and that there. See, the tornado had went through there about 3 days before that, and so we had white caps go over our heads all the time, and you was wet continually. But the water temperature was 87 degrees. So it was warm when you started out. But by the next day, when you'd been in it over 12 hours, I think I was at it, I'd say 14 to 16 hours, somewhere in between. I was so weak from being in the water so long, and of course we hadn't eaten in maybe 30 hours, that I couldn't even climb the ropes on the ship. What the Grayson did is they couldn't stop, because then they'd get a torpedo. So they kept going, but they put a boat. And the boat took one circle, picked up eight of us, and then while they were picking us up and we was getting on, a torpedo went under the ship. The sailors said it had been set a little too deep, maybe for a battle wagon or aircraft carrier. So then when we got up, of course, and got on, two sailors came down and got me under the arms and brought me over the, because I couldn't climb. I was just so tired and that. And then Dyke says, well, let's thank the Lord. So we knelt down there and prayed. And there were about 100 sailors around us, plus officers and that. And I can remember when we prayed, they were just all quiet. There was really respect
Anyone who ever had the privilege of meeting Jonas Hofer had nothing but respect for him. Again, you can access the full stories of any of these late veterans we honor today at hometownheroesradio.com. And our Memorial Day special continues after this.